The time is 6:29, and welcome to In Our Backyard, WORT's local news Monday through Thursday. I'm Laura Goodkind.
And I'm Christopher Schultz. Tonight, In Our Backyard,
voices from the Take Back the Night rally.
Mark Pocan introduces new workers' rights legislation.
Farmland assessment reduction, help for farmers, or just a developer's boondoggle?
A path to peace in the Middle East from the Madison Tycoon community.
And Leia's Kitchen Review. But first, here are today's top stories in our backyard for Monday, April 28th, 2003.
As budget cuts at the state and local level across the country severely affect social services, victims of sexual assault and domestic violence are suffering as well. At this Saturday's Take Back the Night rallies at the Capitol, speakers reminded onlookers that sexual violence is still a major problem and that victims need to come forward. But as Steve Zelaznik reports, dealing with sex crimes is more difficult as communities face tighter budgets.
The rally was named Take Back the Night to remind people night is the most dangerous time and that night symbolizes silence. Angela Rose, chair of the Wisconsin chapter of the National Organization for Women, is trying to get women to break that silence. At Saturday's rally at the state capitol, she recalled when she was assaulted herself.
I was leaving my job at a shopping mall. I was 17 years old, and a man came up behind me with a knife, put it to my throat. He forced me into his car, bound my hands behind my back, and put Band-Aids and sunglasses over my face. He had me for about 4 hours, and I was sexually assaulted. And when I went to the police station that night, the detective, after I told him my story, start to finish, he stopped and looked at me and said, "Are you lying?" And I was outraged. I got up and I walked out. Nothing was done on my case until the following Monday, when we had two more detectives that were just incredible that took my case on. And because of the description that I gave of his face was so accurate, about a week later, they caught him.
But Angela notes her case is rare. Most sexual predators assault people they know. When she spoke to groups about her experience, the extent of the problem surprised her.
I was just absolutely amazed at how many people would want to talk to me afterwards. I'd have a whole line of people that said, "Hey, you know what? This happened to me. This happened to my sister, my brother, my mom, my best friend." And I was just astonished at how widespread sexual assault was in our society and how no one talks about it.
Because reporting is low, it's difficult to tell whether the problem is getting better or worse, according to Kelly Anderson of the Dane County Rape Crisis Center.
In the country, according to the FBI and the DOJ and all those kinds of folks, only about 1 in 10 rapes is ever reported. So when you're dealing with such a small reporting rate, a tiny difference in reports can make it look like you have a lot more rape or a lot less rape. And this happened recently in Madison when the 2001 forcible rape numbers went from, 60-something to 80-something in 2002. It looked like a huge jump. And what we don't know is whether that means there were more sexual assaults or whether fewer were reported in 2001 for some reason or more were reported in 2002.
But most agree reporting has increased in recent years, which constrains support groups, especially in these economic times.
As domestic violence and other violence against women, sexual assault, become easier for the community to talk about, more people do come forward, and people come forward at a time when we're all losing funding.
Kim Wright is with the Domestic Abuse Intervention Service in Madison. Her group is being hit hard. This fall, they lost a $1 million federal grant, and Wisconsin may cut aid to counties and cities in an effort to eliminate its budget shortfall. The Domestic Abuse Intervention Service may have to lay off advocates who accompany victims to court. If these layoffs become necessary, Kim Wright warns that more victims will be afraid to come forward.
There are some people that the effects of trauma, their own personal whatever, that they really need an advocate to go with them and want an advocate to go with them. And I would guess if someone tried to go through something alone they weren't ready for, they may never do it again. Or, if they felt they really couldn't, go down and represent themselves or without support, that they just might not go.
Wright says her organization is okay for now, but the future is uncertain.
Everybody patched their budgets together for this year. But then it's still really up in the air what the funding is for all those positions again next year.
The Domestic Abuse Intervention Service, along with other groups, is receiving increased private support. But as states, counties, and municipalities continue to cut their aid, the future of sexual assault and domestic abuse violence groups is uncertain. For In Our Backyard, I'm Steve Zelaznik.
Currently, state public employees are not allowed the right to strike or arbitration. This afternoon, WORT reporter Mara Zimmerman talked with State Representative Mark Pocan, who, along with Fred Risser, introduced a bill that would give state workers these options.
Fred Risser and I have introduced a bill that would allow for a collective bargaining and ultimately a right to strike provision for state employees, much like local government employees currently have under state statute. Unfortunately, that is not extended to state employees. So the whole mess that we've had for the last 22 months with state employees working without having their pay raises that they've been due from contract negotiations very likely would never occur under this new process, and it would be very similar to what they do in the state of Minnesota and others.
Would there be any employees exempt from this?
Yeah, there'd be some employees exempt, obviously for emergency and some other reasons, but nonetheless, it would still set up, even for those people, an arbitration process so that, again, if there is an impasse, currently state employees have absolutely no recourse. This would allow state employees at least the right to be able to go to an arbitration, have an outside person look at what the information is and make sure that negotiations continue rather than just get stalled up. Especially what happened with this set of contracts and having them stalled purely for political reasons, that would never happen under the provisions of this bill.
What about striking, though? If the employees struck, could they strike and just walk off the job under the provision of this bill?
Striking is generally the last case thing that's going to happen, and it's used very rarely. I think people probably can't remember the last strike that occurred in Wisconsin at a big level, at a municipal level. And again, that's what this statute would follow. Really, it's setting up the arbitration process and other mechanisms so that you can get a contract resolution rather than have to go to strike. However, I can tell you in Minnesota under Governor Ventura, they did have a situation where the state employees struck, and it was only for a day or two, and they were back at the table and got everything taken care of. So it's a good vehicle to have, but again, I don't think either state employees or the state government want anyone to have to go to that level, but it's important that they have that power or else they are powerless.
That was State Representative Mark Pocan talking with In Our Backyard reporter Mara Zimmerman. And now for a roundup of the news in brief, it's tonight's Backyard Beat.
Employees of the state of Wisconsin got some good news today, as the most recent Badger poll has found that the majority of the general public holds them in high regard. 76% of those surveyed said that they believe state workers are just as honest as their private sector counterparts, and 52% said that they believe state workers put about as much effort into their jobs as workers in the private sector. The poll was conducted from April 8th through the 15th by the hardworking folks at the University of Wisconsin Survey Center, and comes as one small piece of good news for the state workers facing job cuts for the first time in more than 20 years due to Wisconsin's $3.2 billion budget deficit.
There will be a public hearing tonight on the controversial cogeneration plant at the University of Wisconsin's Madison campus. The meeting starts at 7 p.m. at the Wiseman Center Auditorium. The center is located next to the University Hospital on Highland Avenue. The proposed 150-megawatt plant would be a joint venture between the university and Madison Gas and Electric. Neighbors and some environmental groups are concerned about the plant's lake water usage, pollution, and expected noise. An independent consultant's report just released today recommended a smaller plant built solely by the UW.
Under a little notice provision of Governor Doyle's state budget, health insurance costs would increase 60% for poor people currently enrolled in Badger Care. The change would affect 18,000 people and would make it very difficult for people living paycheck to paycheck, said John Peacock of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families.
Five state legislators paid no state income taxes in 2000 and 2001, and four others paid less than $1,000 during the same period. Representative Sondé Pope Roberts, Democrat of Verona, the only area legislator on the list, said the death of her husband eliminated any tax liability for those 2 years. These records were reported in the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Tomorrow morning, the state legislatures and Joint Committee on Employment Relations will be meeting and may take action on the long-delayed state workers' contract issue. Unionized state workers have been without a contract since July of 2001. Meanwhile, state legislators and non-represented state employees have been getting regular increases. And those are today's top stories. Up next, an interview with Dane County Treasurer Dave Gawenda.
Bye-bye. The time is 6:39, and this is In Our Backyard, homegrown news on WORT. As many in the agricultural community know, farmers have long been able to pay reduced property taxes. Under the Farmland Use Value Assessment Law, land is taxed on its ability to produce income from agriculture rather on its potential market value. A new state act changed the penalty landowners would have to pay to convert farmland to other uses. Critics have said that even with these changes, the developers will benefit at the expense of taxpayers. This afternoon, WORT reporter Mara Zimmerman talked with Dane County Treasurer Dave Gawanda about this law.
The value of your land for a new subdivision was so high that your property taxes were much higher than you could pay just trying to make a living in farming.
Now, I've heard critics say that this really helps developers and is mainly a boondoggle for developers. Can you explain why they would think that?
Well, I think that's probably because the law doesn't distinguish between whether you're growing crops because this is what you do for your livelihood or whether you're doing it just as a way to generate some income while you're waiting for an opportunity to sell it for home sites or a strip mall.
Now, I understand that, I actually speak from some personal experience, that this does drop your values of your property quite significantly, but that would mean that that would have to be picked up by somebody else. Or else services would be lowered.
Yeah. Actually, what we've seen now that this has been in effect for a few years is, for the most part, the amount that the unit of government spends can't change that much. And so, if the farmers pay that much less, then the people who live in the villages and the cities have to make up the difference.
I see. I have also noted that this is a new change now, that this bill has been in effect for quite a while, but they have a new, they call it a penalty, that if this is reverted back to some form of a housing or something other than farm use, they pay a penalty, but that penalty has been lessened because of, my understanding is that prior to January of this year, they were paying the difference between what the fair market value was and the assessed value if they turned it over for the last 3 years. But now they've changed that to something in that would be lower even yet, that the governments would be recouping. Is that true?
I think basically, Mara, you're right, although let me flesh out some of the details.
Okay.
Under the old system, the local treasurer, so the treasurer in that township or village or city, was supposed to administer a penalty when that land left farming for development. But most of the treasurers didn't seem to be doing it or didn't do it thoroughly. And so starting January 1st of this year, counties are the ones administering the penalty instead. But the penalty itself changed, and it's now probably going to mean a smaller dollar amount than the old system. But I think it means it's more likely, because the county treasurer is going to do it, that it'll actually be levied and be collected. So on the one hand, the penalty is less, but on the other hand, I think we're going to have a much greater compliance rate, and so we'll probably still end up with more dollars being paid in the penalty than what was the case under the old system.
I understand also that the city of Madison has several suits pending with the old penalty that they're planning to recoup. So this area was very diligent about recouping their development money?
Yes, I think that in Dane County, as an example, where we have 61 different municipalities, there were a number of them that were pretty vigilant in collecting this. Mm-hmm. And the city of Madison, and anyone who's familiar with the city knows the kind of growth that's occurred on the periphery, they had a lot of potential penalty dollars out there. And a couple of the big developers have been fighting them in court because the developers question whether they should pay, at least if not pay the penalty, they're questioning whether the amount the city calculated is appropriate. One of the difficulties with the old penalty is that assessor had to make that estimate of what the fair market value is. And often the landowner, the developer, would disagree as to what the fair market value compared to what the city assessor felt. The new system doesn't require that estimate of fair market value, so I don't anticipate that there'll be the kind of challenges under the new system as we've had under the old system.
Well, will the new system only go back 3 years also?
Actually, the new penalty doesn't go back at all. It is a dollar amount per acre based on the selling price the previous year of agricultural land. So the State Department of Revenue every fall will calculate a dollar penalty per acre for each county in the state. Every county will be a little different, and then they will tell each county in the fall what the following year's penalty is going to be. For instance, in Dane County, if you take less than 10 acres out of production, that penalty is about $315 an acre. If you take more than 30 acres out of production, it's about $158 an acre. And then if it's between 10 and 30, the amount of penalty per acre is between $315 and $158. Now, you know, one of the other criticisms you hear is that you actually get a lower per acre penalty if you take larger amounts of acreage out of production, but I'm afraid that's the way the law was written.
Also, it's my understanding that if you're a developer, for instance, and you decide that you want to develop this piece of property that's been in farm cropland for a while, you could turn it over to some sort of a grazing situation and for a year, and then you wouldn't have to pay any penalty. Is that true?
Well, that's true in that right now to get the ag use assessment, you have to have your land cropped. If a developer or a farmer who wants to develop land, for that matter, if they didn't crop the land for a year, it would no longer be assessed as ag. The assessed value would go up a bit, comparable to what it would be worth as pasture land. But then when it's converted from pasture land, there's no penalty. The only time you pay a penalty is when you convert it from ag production. So if my concern is that property owners will try to exploit that particular wrinkle in the law and end up avoiding the penalty by just going through that intermediate step.
That was Dave Gawanda speaking with Mara Zimmerman about changes in the state law to reduce farm owners' taxes.
Speaking to us this evening from San Francisco is Marisa Handler, a national organizer for the Tikkun community. Welcome to In Our Backyard.
Hi there.
Hi there. First of all, can you tell us just what Tikkun community is?
The Tikkun community is an international interfaith group of people working to make change in the world from the inside and the outside.
Okay, and what connection does Tikkun community have with Tikkun magazine?
Well, the magazine has been around for about 16 years and has been publishing. We have a large circulation, and the community was established basically as a place for people to be active around many of the ideas that are expressed in the magazine.
And
so that's the essential connection.
Okay, what types of views specifically are expressed in the magazine? What types of views are expressed specifically in the magazine?
That's a good question. There's many different kinds of views. The magazine calls itself a liberal Jewish critique. And so specifically of late, I suppose in the last few years, being that Tikkun is a community based out of Judaism, although it's very much an interfaith and diverse community, a lot of our energy has been focused on Israel and Palestine. And calling for an immediate end to the occupation as a very much necessary prerequisite to any sort of just peace in the area. So there's been a lot of attention focused on that. In terms of current American foreign policy, also a lot of attention both within the magazine and within the community and the Tikkun Campus Network on talking about what are real routes to gaining security. We don't believe that gaining security through controlling and dominating other countries is actually going to bring security to this country. We believe that generating goodwill on the part of other nations, on the part of this population, is going to bring real security to this country. So those are some of the things that we're dealing with right now.
Okay. Does the stance that your organization takes, as you had put it, a liberal Jewish critique, does that differ from traditional Jewish teachings at all? Or do they hold still pretty much in line?
I mean, we really think the movement, in terms of the religious roots, they're within Renewal Judaism, and Renewal is based really around the concept of bringing a lot of what we see as the old values back to bear. Judaism has a history, a really wonderful history of discussion and debate and analysis and critical thinking and very much radical thinking, which often we don't see as prevalent, I think, in the contemporary American Jewish community, or perhaps I should say the institutions that represent themselves as the contemporary American Jewish community, like AIPAC. We don't really see that kind of thinking embracing discussion or debate or radical change, particularly when it comes to Israel. We very much think that in terms of where it's coming from in Judaism, that it's very, very deeply based in things coming from the Torah, from the Mishnah, from the Bible.
Okay. What types of response have you received from the Jewish community at large with regard to your views of the Palestinian or Israeli conflict?
It varies, and I must say it's also difficult to tell what is the Jewish community at large, because I think that what's happened over the past, particularly over the past decade or so, is that institutions that have always represented the American Jewish community have, in some cases, moved, or in other cases, been pushed to the right, as Israel's own policy has moved to the right, just because they see their role as supporting Israel. And the way we see it, there isn't often enough critical thinking and questioning going on in that process. So those organizations are often quite hostile to the work that we're doing. I've done a good amount of traveling and speaking about this, and I've encountered a good amount of hostility towards these views. I've called things like self-hating Jew and stuff like that. My belief, though, is that this actually is not the majority of the Jewish population. Rather, it's the organized and moneyed minority. So what I often find is that there's a lot of people that are open to this message. And then there's a growing number of Jews that are very active around this message, which is exciting.
Great. What type of view does your organization hold of Ariel Sharon?
I'm not sure whether we have an official view of Ariel Sharon, but what I can definitely say is that, Sharon was voted in because he promised security to the Israeli people, and I very firmly do not believe that the actions that he's taking right now, these very extreme measures in the name of security, are actually going to bring security. In fact, they're generating much more hostility on the part of the Palestinian population. Understandably, there's an illegal occupation. There's all sorts of repression, not just terrorists, but often many civilians are killed in the process of maintaining this occupation. It's a very unjust, unfair way to attempt to bring security to Israel, and ultimately, we believe, far more detrimental than it is helpful in terms of just undermining, future peace between these two peoples who are going to have to live together as neighbors. So basically, on the whole, not very approving of Mr. Sharon.
Okay, appreciate that. Well, we've been speaking with Marisa Handler, a national organizer for the Tikkun community.
And can I just add something?
Sure, go ahead, very quickly.
All right, so I will be speaking at 7 p.m. on April 30th in the Humanities Building, room 1121 on Madison's campus. The other thing is that there's a very active Tikkun Campus Network chapter on campus, and on May 8th, they are doing a rock project, which is in the name of healing between Israel and Palestine.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Heavily symbolic.
Yeah, we are
in the Library Mall, so I just wanted to get that in there.
Okay, we appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
The time is 6:54, and this is Handcrafted Local News from WORT 89.9 FM. And now we bring you the Kitchen Review, where the politics of taste meet the cuisine of the unemployed.
I'm happy to report on a new consortium. It is not an American subsidiary of Royal Dutch Shell. This is a report from Slow Food USA on the inauguration of the American Raw Milk Farmstead Cheese Consortium. Through the consortium, Slow Food says it will raise awareness nationally and abroad of American raw milk farmstead cheeses. It will defend the right of these cheeses to be produced and enjoyed. In other words, listeners, your right to buy will be defended. Carlo Petrini, Slow Food International president, issued a manifesto in defense of raw milk products 2 years ago at the Salone del Giusto in Italy. They have persisted and insisted on the right of raw milk to the European Union through their lobbying office in Brussels. Slow Food feels that American raw milk cheeses are poised to grow in appreciation and popularity, just as U.S. wines have over the past 20 years. Raw farmstead milk reflects the character of the terrain where it is produced. Several tastings planned for this year will identify cheeses for placement on the Slow Food Arc of Taste, which lists foods produced by traditional methods that are in danger of disappearing either from lack of markets, overzealous regulations, or the challenges encountered in their production. 30 cheeses have been selected for the Arc, including one from Wisconsin, and Edam by Stevenson's Sustenance, and that's at Coopersville, Wisconsin. How do you tell if food is bad? There's taste, appearance, smell. A page one story last week by the Chicago Tribune, with information gathered from the Freedom of Information Act, found the U.S. Department of Agriculture, numerous state departments of agriculture, some state departments of education, and a few health departments failed the smell test. A broken ammonia pipe at a processor contaminated an untold number of hamburger packages, potato wedges, and cheese, and who knows what else. The Tribune story quoted one school food service director of absolutely refusing to serve the food. Did I forget to say the contaminated food was destined for the school lunch program? Last Saturday afternoon, I went to what I thought was a reception at the Cardinal Bar for presidential candidate Vermont Governor Dean. He wasn't there. Only some supporters. The sandwich wraps were moist and meaty. The focaccia was a bit dry. The fruit plate was lovely with ripe pineapple, strawberries, and kiwi. The very hot salsa almost undid me. At the Café Montmartre at the next hour, there was an author's reception for William Timpson, Teaching and Learning Peace. A vegetarian antipasto plate of caponata, feta cheese. Montmartre's is the creamiest I've ever tasted. Sliced tomatoes, roasted garlic, artichokes, and a fresh French bread were fodder for peace. I segued nicely into the peace sing-along with Ann Feeney, Chris, Vicky Guzman, down from Canada, and other local songsters. It was a potluck. Next sing-along from the May Day to Earth Day Committee this Saturday night at the Atwood Community Center. For the Kitchen Review, looking a gift horse in the mouth, this is your WORT food critic, Leah Zeldin.
And this has been a production of In Our Backyard, WORT's local news at 6:30 Monday through Thursday. Our reporters tonight were Steve Zelaznik, Mara Zimmerman, and Harry Richardson. Our engineer was Mary Beth. Tonight's show was produced by the In Our Backyard Collective. Special thanks to the WORT staff collective and all of our listeners. I'm Laura Gutknecht.
And I'm Christopher Schultz. In Our Backyard needs you. If you have ever wanted to help with the only all-volunteer-run local news show, now is the time. We welcome all volunteers and provide all training. Stay tuned next for the Access Hour. We'll be back in your ears next Monday at 6:30. Until then, good night.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.